In-depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Usable news and information for your job. And now, here's Francis Rose.
Welcome to the program. For Tuesday, February 7th, 2011, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, my guests for the hour today are joining me in the executive suite. Every Tuesday at 3 o'clock, the biggest federal government decision makers and the biggest, most difficult challenges that federal executives face are the subjects of our conversations in the executive suite. We take you inside the decision-making process and look at how those decisions are made. The federal government has a lot of organizations that are working to combat terrorism, and I don't think anyone would be surprised that the Defense Department and the Homeland Security Department have extensive operations in this area. But some of the other agencies that work in this space might not seem so obvious. Today's guests are authors of the book U.S. Government Counterterrorism, A Guide to Who Does What. Ambassador Edward Marks is a consultant, speaker, and author on terrorism, interagency coordination, United Nations affairs, and complex international emergencies. He was appointed into the Foreign Service in 1956, retired as a senior Foreign Service officer in 1995, recalled to active duty in 2002 as the State Department's advisor on terrorism to the United States Pacific Command. He served there as in that role for three years. And has been U.S. Ambassador to Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde, also served as Deputy Chief of Mission and then Chargé d'Affaires to the Republic of Sri Lanka. Ambassador Marks, thanks for being with me on the program today. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you. It's our pleasure.
Michael Kraft is a Washington-based counterterrorism consultant, writer, and editor with more than 30 years of experience working on terrorism issues in the State Department, Congress, and the private sector. His consultancy projects have included work for Homeland Security and Defense and a current program to help strengthen the resilience of American cities. He served 19 years at the State Department's Counterterrorism Office, working with the Justice Department in drafting and enacting legislation. He also served for 10 years on congressional staff as staff director of the Senate Foreign Relations Middle East Subcommittee and as a national security legislative assistant to two members of Congress. Mr. Kraft, it's a pleasure to have you in the studio. Thanks for being
Thanks
here today.
Thanks very much for having us.
Happy to do it. This book is filling a space that has existed for a long time. How did you become aware of this space, that this was something that you should address in the form of this book? Why don't we start with you, Mr. Kraft?
Well, just partly because we both worked in the interagency process, and we kept coming across offices and organizations that we didn't normally deal with, and sometimes wondered, you know, who's doing what in Department X. And then I worked on a project for a House Foreign Affairs Committee on the U.S. assistance to other countries dealing with bioterrorism, and their whole slew of agencies doing that. And from that, we got the idea. We bounced around with several professors and others and said, hey, there's no unclassified version of who does what.
Mm-hmm.
The title actually came from a friend of ours in Treasury who said some of his British and Australian colleagues kept asking, who does what in the U.S. government?
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to fill that gap.
It's pretty straightforward, and I like straightforward, Ambassador, so I was drawn to the title right away. How has the definition or the concept of terrorism changed in our definition, in our minds here in the United States over the past 20 to 40 years?
Well, 9/11, of course, was in a sense a seminal moment, a changing moment.
Mm-hmm.
As we point out, there's nothing new about terrorism. It's been around for thousands of years. And it's been involved and infected the United States in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, the whole period of hijackings. But 9/11 changed it by bringing it home in a very direct way, where we all watched it happen on television and cause casualties in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, the definition hasn't changed, but its impact on us as a nation and a country has changed.
So it's more an issue of profile than definition or concept?
I'm not sure how to exactly look at it. It's about violence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about violence directed against people outside of the normal, if I can say normal, wartime situation.
Mm-hmm.
And affecting people as private citizens and as individuals and as noncombatants. So it's something that's intruding into our life privately and publicly in a way that we just hadn't thought about before.
Yeah, that I think that's what I was getting at, because I'm just thinking back to September 10th, 2001, and I think if you asked 100 people walking down the street in Washington, D.C. what terrorism was, probably 90 of them had really never given it any thought at all, let alone what it meant to them and trying to gauge what that was.
Well, actually, there's something like 110 different definitions that have been identified by some academics.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. definition has been pretty constant since the 1980s. It's politically motivated violence against noncombatants with the intention to influence policy, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But Ed's right, 9/11 was a turning point, but actually some of the programs date way back there. I mean, for example, efforts to go after to improve counterterrorism training for other countries and even counterterrorism financing. But 9/11 resulted in a big increase in resources. But the impact on American citizens is much more visible in the sense of the barriers around government buildings and the airport screening devices, some of which, you know, existed previously, but they were not so obtrusive in the past.
I want to ask you about a few concepts in the book before we get into the agencies themselves and the operations themselves. A couple of things here that jumped out at me and that I found particularly interesting. The era of boutique terrorism. What is the difference between boutique terrorism and your common, ordinary, garden variety terrorism?
Well, what we meant by boutique terrorism, I forget who coined the phrase, it might have been Brian Jenkins out of RAND, was the period in the 60s and 70s when you had these units, these organizations in Europe, the Red Brigade, the Brigitte Rosso, the various groups in Germany, Italy. And these tended to be fairly small groups, 10, 20, 30, 40 people, basically from the disaffected upper, children of the disaffected upper class.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, and in, particularly in Italy and in Germany and in European leftist circles, there was a certain chicness, a certain political chicness about, if not being members of these groups, a sort of recognizing they had a role to play.
Mm-hmm.
So there was kind of a European political fashion for them, out of which came the phrase boutique.
Is that along the lines of the Symbionese Liberation Army that Patty Hearst was involved with?
A little bit.
Same idea?
Yes, very much so. But it more or less arose out of the European situation.
Mm-hmm.
Then. But you're quite right.
I guess the difference there, when I think back on that particular incident, I'm not as well versed on what happened in Europe in the same idea, but it seems to me that for the most part, I mean, those groups didn't commit the kinds of acts on nearly the scale of what we think about terrorism today. Is that fair to say?
Right, right. They were smaller groups, and they tended to commit individual kidnappings like that of Patty Hearst in the United States, individual assassinations of either government officials or private businessmen, or the kidnapping of an American general in Italy. They were not committing this sort of large-scale bombing attacks, which we unfortunately become used to expecting from the broader-based, much more political, much more dangerous organizations of the last 20 years.
Yeah, I think what happened, most of these groups had relatively narrow focus goals. In some cases, especially Latin America, just wanting their manifestos published. And I would say the boutique terrorism also applied to Latin America, you know, Che Guevara, you know, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think the threshold was crossed probably, you know, with the emergence of Al-Qaeda and these broader groups. And their desire was basically to kill as many of the, quote, other as possible, mm-hmm. rather than getting individual prisoners released from jail or, you know, or a specific goal.
Another concept I'd like to ask you about, terrorism versus freedom fighter. The difference may seem self-evident, but is the difference actually what it appears to be on the surface?
It is not self-evident, to be honest. It is often very much a matter of perspective.
Mm-hmm.
The old phrase, whether one is a freedom fighter or a terrorist, depends to a large degree on whether you approve of the action.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, freedom fighters, and they include some we revere in our history, have often used violence in ways that were not part of the traditional military set of standards. Mm-hmm. It is a question of definition to the question of perspective. As Mike mentioned, there are hundreds of definitions of terrorism. And while there is a legitimate difference of perspective, I think most of us, most people would say there is a line beyond which the use of violence cannot be justified because the cause itself may be just.
Mm-hmm.
But even for just causes, there are limits beyond which you should not and cannot go.
Mm-hmm.
I have a slightly different take, perhaps, than Ed does, that dividing line, I think, is whether the groups are deliberately attacking civilians and non-combatants. This issue came up in Africa, for example. Whether if they're going after police stations or military installations, even with unconventional warfare, that's considered more of a terrorism. But if they're deliberately blowing up marketplaces and airliners, as far as I'm concerned, that goes beyond freedom fighters. They're taking it on to a much deeper and darker level.
That's the voice of Michael Kraft. He is one of the co-authors of a book called U.S. Government Counterterrorism, A Guide to Who Does What. His co-author is also in the studio with me, Ambassador Edward Marks, and we'll continue our conversation on Federal News Radio 1500 AM in just a moment.
The Federal IT Challenge is a series exploring the administration's aim to fundamentally change how the federal government purchases and uses IT, and a discussion around one of the biggest goals, reducing the number of federal data centers by at least 40% by 2015. During the show, Doug Bourgeois, Vice President and Federal Chief Cloud Executive for VMware, commented.
Platform as a service is a critical layer in the cloud stack. Infrastructure as a service was only the first step towards the cloud. The platform enables agencies to develop, deploy, and use applications in more agile ways. It allows them to accelerate their time to value for mission applications and continue the savings journeys that they've already begun with their journey to infrastructure as a service in this difficult, constraining budget environment.
To hear the Federal IT Challenge in its entirety and learn more about the journey to cloud computing, go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword VMware. That's federalnewsradio.com, keyword VMware.
Navy Rear Admiral retired Elizabeth A. Height, Vice President, U.S. Public Sector Cybersecurity Practice, HP Enterprise Services, on the Cybersecurity Combating Threats to Our Software Environment panel, sponsored by Hewlett-Packard.
We look at applications and software development from an architectural view today. At least we should, because quite frankly, it's so much easier to design security in than to find the thousands or tens of thousands of vulnerabilities that might exist in that software at a later date once deployed.
Could your IT security have made you less secure? Traditional IT security defenses, firewalls, encryption, and intrusion detection systems are extremely effective, and that's the problem. They're so good that the bad guys are now training their sights on a new target: exploitable vulnerabilities in software applications. HP can help governments secure mission-critical applications by designing security in from the beginning, finding the vulnerabilities inside existing software, and fixing them quickly and cost-effectively. To learn more, visit federalnewsradio.com/HP.
Register now for AFSEA's 11th Annual Homeland Security Event, February 28th through March 1st at the Reagan Center. Focusing on vigilance during challenging times, doing more without more, this is the venue where you will hear firsthand about the critical IT issues facing our country in the fight against terrorism. This event is proudly sponsored by AT&T, Booz Allen Hamilton, CenturyLink, General Dynamics, InfoZen, NJVC, Kinetic North America, SAIC, and Verizon, and features speakers from all levels of government, military, and industry. Panelists from across the Homeland Security enterprise will dialogue on border security, cyberspace, immigration, disaster response, doing business with DHS, and other critical issues. Contractors and agencies will showcase the latest security products and solutions in the exposition. Register to attend or exhibit at afcea.org, keyword homeland. That's afcea.org.
Tom Temin here with a preview of tomorrow's Federal Drive. Manish Chopra has been a groundbreaking chief technology officer. Now he's leaving the federal government. He'll join us for an exit interview. Plus, some members of Congress are less than impressed with the White House cyber coordinator position. We'll hear from one of them. Those stories and more tomorrow morning, starting at 6 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, be sure to visit federalnewsradio.com.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My guests on the program today, Ambassador Edward Marks and Michael Kraft. They're the co-authors of the book, U.S. Government Counterterrorism, A Guide to Who Does What. You can learn more about it and find a link to the book on Amazon at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. We were talking during the break, Ambassador, that this book is informational at the beginning, informational at the end, is more referential in the middle. And that's where I'd like to go, is to just talk about some of the information that you have in the middle of the book about how some of the components of the federal government are involved in counterterrorism. You have a chapter devoted to the intelligence community, and the collection of all of the intelligence agencies, or all the main intelligence agencies under the umbrella of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, has been fairly controversial. What have you seen as you've been watching this issue since ODNI was stood up and the agencies are ostensibly sharing information better through ISE and so on?
Well, first, we must, I think, understand what we mean by the intelligence community. There are 16 formal members of the intelligence community. We've all heard about the Central Intelligence Agency, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And the Defense Department has a very large intelligence organization. Department of State has its own intelligence office, but also other departments have them, down to and including the Coast Guard. And this all reflects the need of all of these organizations who are involved in law enforcement, protection of the country, national security, in some way need to gather and to analyze intelligence. They all do it from their own perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
And this is appropriate. They need to do it that way. But intelligence moves across agency border lines, department border lines. And while all of these have worked very well and very hard to take care of their own agency's needs, 9/11 proved that we needed to what's called connect the dots. We needed to pass information back and forth. A major requirement of all American of security information in the United States government has always been the rule of need to know.
Mm-hmm.
You only should have information you need to know to do your job.
Yes.
But terrorism crosses lines, crosses military lines, crosses civilian lines, crosses the borders. And the old mantra of need to know is not good enough. We now need to have a new mantra of need to share with
mm-hmm.
each other.
Mm-hmm.
And the purpose of the new organization is to put a cap over the individual agencies and bring them more into being a community where they work with each other, share information on a regular, normal basis. That's the function of ODNI, and I think everybody will say it's a work in progress, but they're making progress along those lines.
And that's encouraging, because not only is there the operational changes that need to take place, but a cultural transformation that has to happen. Mr. Kraft, your experience with government, I'm sure, is the same that a lot of others have had, which is that sometimes the cultural component of change can be more difficult than the operational component. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I've had friends who've sat in the fusion centers and say, well, somebody from such and such agency is sitting there, but he's not sharing information.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm talking about 10 years ago.
Sure.
And there's a lot of talk about the cultural aspects. There's another component, too, is federal, state, local, of sharing information down to the state and local people. Because, you know, a number of terrorist attacks have been stopped by smart cops on the beat or border guard agencies, et cetera. And that's still considerably a work in progress,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of effort's been going on there to try to improve the flow of information, decide what can be shared without risking being compromised by some police chief who is too inclined to talk to the press about something mm-hmm. ongoing.
And I might add a very concrete example of what we mean by these difference on agency needs and culture. One of the major problems was that CIA is interested in getting information to find out what's going on to prevent stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI needs intelligence information so they can take people to court,
mm-hmm.
convict them. So they both had a different view of what information was used for.
Mm-hmm.
And they now need to combine that. And it's difficult because they are tasked with different jobs.
Mm-hmm. And they have different perspectives, too, I would imagine, on what the other person might need, even in a need-to-share environment, I would imagine. Because I would think if you're sitting in one agency, you don't want to overwhelm your colleague at another agency with information he or she may not need. But at the same time, maybe you shouldn't be the person deciding what he or she might need. That should be up to him or her.
Well, that's one reason they've tried to develop a system of cross-fertilization. For example, in State Department Counterterrorism Office, there was an FBI representative sitting there, and there are State Department people in with DOD and with FBI, and just trying to get some of that that liaison going.
Your book lists any number of and talks about a number of intelligence agencies that I didn't know existed. I should have assumed that they existed, but I just never thought about it before. I did not know the Energy Department had an Office of Intelligence and Counterintelligence, although since they're responsible for securing, for example, the electrical grid, makes sense that they would want to be able to collect information about that.
And nuclear questions.
Mm-hmm. Actually.
A lot of information about the various agencies in the intelligence communities, in the intelligence community, and some that are not. We'll talk about the Defense Department when we come back from the break, gentlemen, if we can, on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My guests for the conversation today are the co-authors of the book U.S. Government Counterterrorism, A Guide to Who Does What, Michael Kraft and Edward Marks. We'll continue our conversation in a moment on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Armin, your home security system gives you peace of mind, but are you paying $30, $40, $50 or more in monitoring fees? Switch to Ackerman Security Systems, the metro area's most trusted name in security, and pay just $18.95 a month. That's right, $18.95 a month, and no cost to switch. Don't have a system? Then Ackerman offers the latest technology, including wireless monitoring. Call by Wednesday and get 3 months of basic monitoring free when you switch or start service with Ackerman. Call 888-999-1070, AckermanSecurity.com.
When every moment matters and a hand reaches out, when someone gives blood and a life is saved, that moment when heartbreak turns to hope, you're there through the American Red Cross. Every day, the Red Cross responds to nearly 200 neighborhood emergencies, and your support makes it possible. Use this moment to join us today. Visit redcross.org.
I have this dream where I'm the head of an army of cybersecurity engineers fighting cyber terrorists around the world. My strategies lead to real-world applications that are shutting down black hats and bringing them to justice. Government agencies and multinational corporations are seeking me out to... Hang on. This isn't some fantasy. This is exactly what my doctorate in information assurance from Capital College is preparing me for.
The online Doctor of Science degree in Information Assurance at Capital gives you absolute validation as an authority on cybersecurity and safeguarding information assets. Capital College is recognized as a national center of academic excellence in information assurance education by the NSA and DHS.
My dream is becoming a reality because of Capital College. It isn't for everyone, but it's perfect for me.
For a virtual info session on graduate programs at Capital College, visit capital-college.edu/radio. That's capital with an O, -college.edu/radio.
Powered by the latest second-generation Intel Xeon processors, new HP ProLiant G7 servers are a perfect high-speed solution for lowering costs, improving utilization, and reducing server sprawl. GovConnection, a federal elite HP partner, can show you how together they can power your data center into the future. Talk to GovConnection's experienced federal sales team, where service and commitment to the customer are priority one. Call 800-800-0019 today.
The Little Heart That Could. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Nicholas Scarlow with HHS HealthBeat. Being a healthy baby means having a healthy heart. Heart defects occur when there is a structure problem with the heart and can lead to functioning problems. It happens during pregnancy, and certain women are at a higher risk. Dr. Stuart Shapira is at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Specifically, women who are obese, women who smoke, or women who have diabetes that is not well controlled during their pregnancy.
Women who are planning a pregnancy can improve their chances of having a healthy baby, too.
Women should talk to their healthcare provider about all medications that they are taking, including prescription, over-the-counter or non-prescription, and herbal medications. And women should talk to their healthcare providers about vaccines.
Learn more at hhs.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Nicholas Garlow.
Your new Cocker Spaniel is waiting to meet you, and you don't have to travel very far. This weekend and almost every weekend, Oldies But Goodies Cocker Spaniel Rescue holds at least one adoption show in the greater D.C. area. Find out where we'll be this weekend by checking out CockerSpanielRescue.com. Stop by to meet the many homeless Cockers of all ages who are looking for their new home. These dogs have already been spayed or neutered and have all their shots. For more information on adoption, fostering, or volunteering, visit CockerSpanielRescue.com.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests today are co-authors of the book U.S. Government Counterterrorism, A Guide to Who Does What. Michael Kraft and Ambassador Edward Marks, both in the studio with me. And I mentioned in the lead-in, nobody's really surprised that the Defense Department and Homeland Security Department have big footprints in the intelligence and counterterrorism world. What do they play the roles, Ambassador, that you would figure most people think that they play when it comes to counterterrorism?
With defense, I think certainly so. Defense Department, after all, is concerned with the traditional questions of national security, mm-hmm. defending the United States physically against physical attacks. So when terrorism has expanded so that it is we are under physical attack, it is quite normal and natural that the Defense Department would take a role in this. And as the problem increases, the role of Defense Department increases. Homeland Security is a little more interesting for two reasons. One, it reflects the view that the definition of national security has changed.
Mm-hmm.
It used to mean external attack by armed forces. Well, that isn't true anymore, as we all know from the terrorism question. So you've got an expanded definition of what is national security, which is not just a question of either side of the border. And because it became such an urgent question, a decision was made in Congress and elsewhere that we needed to pull together various departments. So we have this new, very, very large department, Homeland Security, which tends to bring together all sorts of departments, which, as you mentioned before, you wouldn't have thought would have a role,
mm-hmm.
now have an important role in this new definition, this new expanded definition of national security.
Now, again, as I look down through the components of these two agencies, DHS and DOD, I saw organizations that I was not familiar with before. The Combating Terrorism Center at West Point, a component in DOD. The question, what are all these agencies doing, sounds a little bit more specious than I'd like it to be, but it's the best way I can think to frame it.
Well, they have specialized functions. For example, the West Point Center, from what I've seen, is primarily academic and research and helping train the officers of the future.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also National Defense University has courses on counterterrorism. Again, their target audience, so to speak, is primarily future officers, though there's some civilians who attend there. So quite often it may sound like they're duplicative, but there's a situation where these groups are focusing for their own audiences. But there's quite a bit of cross-sharing, like the West Point Center. They send out their research papers and things quite freely, mm-hmm. within the government. And they do good work, I must say.
If I may make a point.
Please.
Aside from all the people, if you will, working actively on terrorism, finding the bad guys, stopping the bad guys, because it's become a problem, we have all sorts of people working on it, and they need to be trained and educated on the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So you have things like the West Point School. We have courses at the National Defense Unit, courses in the military, courses everywhere. And in fact, if I might put in a plug, our book is designed, if you will, for terrorism 101 courses for people who are just beginning to be introduced to the subject because they're going to be working on it,
mm-hmm.
both in the federal government, state and local government. And our book is, in a sense, an introduction to who's doing it,
mm-hmm.
and what do you have to think about.
To that end, you have information in the DHS chapter about the fusion centers. They've been kind of the axis of the discussion about sharing information and distributing information both vertically and horizontally. Talk about, Mr. Kraft, your vision, your experience with the fusion centers. You mentioned earlier that you've been in some of these fusion centers. What are you seeing as far as how they're fulfilling the vision that DHS had for them when they were established?
I haven't actually been in them, but I talked to some people.
Thank you.
The concept is sort of two ways. One is sharing information downward from the federal government to state and local, also state and local going up. And I should add maybe a third laterally. And they vary quite a bit because the local states and governments really control them, and some are pretty broad-based, and some partly because of financial reasons or the leadership are, you know, fairly narrow or not staffed up. Part of the function or the role they play is just bringing the various groups together, you know, the fire chiefs, police department, and others. I remember at one meeting, the head of the Northern Virginia Fusion Center said their best piece of equipment was the conference room.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not all the fancy gadgets, et cetera. And so they play that kind of role. But they do vary quite a bit.
The roles that the fusion centers play, are they resource-intensive? Are they human-intensive? What's really going on? I think that statement kind of indicates that the relationships are probably the most important thing there.
Yeah, well, they require the local, state, or city governments to dedicate somebody to work with it, so they are resource intensive, and funding has gotten to be a problem for some of these places. They're not the big equipment users such as the first responders. I mean, that's been a whole new area of providing better equipment to local and state governments. But I don't think the fusion centers themselves are quite, you know, except maybe for the computerized equipment, are not, you know, not as deep into the hardware, so to speak.
One tactic that I noticed that you employed in this book, and it's particularly noteworthy to me in the Homeland Security section, is that you approach the issue of cybersecurity similar to the way that the Defense Department does, breaking it out into its own domain. There is a school of thought that cybersecurity either should be treated now or will be treated soon in a more integrated way into the rest of the mission, whatever mission it is, inside the other four domains at DOD. Do you foresee a point in the future where cybersecurity is more integrated into the counterterrorism efforts of other organizations rather than having a separate cybersecurity element for counterterrorism?
Well, as usual, the answer is both. We've just created, Defense Department just created a new cyber command because the whole question of cyber activity and cybersecurity is crucial to the military. So they're going to be a big player with a big... But it's something that everybody has to have in some way or another.
Mm-hmm.
If you're dealing with security, if you're dealing with classified information, you need control. And you're using the Internet, as we all are, in increasing amounts. It's going to be the same thing. Everybody's going to do intelligence, and everybody has to work with others. Everybody does cyber. Everybody's going to have to work with others. It's there we go. One from column A and one from column B.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think one thing that makes a difference is the technical nature of it, too. It's not the kind of thing you can just plug policy wonks like us into it because it's so specialized. But I think we're sort of in the relatively early stages, and state governments and federal government, too, is realizing how the infrastructure can be affected. I think there's a report somewhere that some railway line had been hacked into. And, of course, all these reports of commerce, you know, businesses, et cetera. So I think it's going to go through an evolution to try to share the information better. But each component, you know, federal, state, local, and private sector, I think want to develop more capabilities in this area.
I mentioned that there are some agencies that are involved in counterterrorism efforts that the average person walking down the street, even the average person in the federal government, might not be aware of. having such a robust presence in counterterrorism. And we'll talk about some of those when we continue our conversation on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My guests, Ambassador Edward Marks and Michael Kraft, authors of the book U.S. Government Counterterrorism, A Guide to Who Does What. And you can find out more about it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. We'll continue in a moment.
Experience GW basketball in one of D.C.'s best college venues, the Colonials Club. As a member of the Colonials Club, you will enjoy a game day atmosphere that is unmatched in Washington area college basketball. Your philanthropic donation and loyal support for GW Athletics provides countless opportunities to our student athletes in pursuit of both their academic and athletic goals. Call 202-994-7325 to join the Colonials Club today and help raise high the buff and blue.
My family struggled, and it was assumed that while I would go to college, I would have to pay for it myself.
Charlie wasn't sure how to get the money she needed for college. Then she found out about federal student aid and the FAFSA.
I don't think I quite realized what a huge deal actually graduating was. Federal student aid definitely made that happen.
Need help planning and paying for college? Find out more at college.gov.
My name is Charlie, and this is my story.
Federal pay and benefits are once again being debated in Congress. The House has passed a one-year extension to the current federal pay freeze, and Senate Republicans have introduced a bill to freeze federal pay and hiring in order to stop massive automatic defense cuts in 2013. FederalNewsRadio.com's pay and benefits page has the latest on congressional action affecting your pocketbook. Find it at FederalNewsRadio.com. Search term pay and benefits.
Newsmakers talk to Emily Kopp.
Rob Shriver, OPM's Deputy General Counsel for Policy.
We really are emphasizing transparency and internship opportunities. So our proposed pathways regulations require agencies to put up on our USA Jobs website some basic information about the internship opportunities that are available to them. It's a requirement that's not currently in place.
Hear the entire interview online at federalnewsradio.com/federaldrive.
Did you know Federal News Radio can also be heard on 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland? Check it out the next time you head to Fort Detrick or the I-270 Technology Corridor. Tune in to Federal News Radio for the latest news and information about the federal government and the federal contracting world. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM or 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland. Federal News Radio, your source for federal news now.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests for the hour today are Michael Kraft and Ambassador Edward Marks, the co-authors of the book U.S. Government Counterterrorism, A Guide to Who Does What. We've talked a little bit about the fact, gentlemen, that this book is informational at the beginning and the end and referential in the middle, referring to various chapters about the federal agencies that participate in the fight against counterterrorism. I want to point out the fact that there are a number of agencies that we are not going to have a chance to talk about today, and I hope at some point we would you'd be able to come back and we could continue the conversation. You write a number of subchapters and a full chapter devoted to the role of Congress, and their role is certainly important because they're giving the money to all of these agencies that are working on this issue. We're not going to have a chance, unfortunately, to talk about Treasury or some of the other agencies that are very heavily involved in counterterrorism. I do want to focus in this segment, though, on the agency from which both of you gentlemen have come, and that's the State Department, and the role that state plays, because I think that's probably one where the perception generally is, well, state is a bunch of diplomats, and they're the guys that are trying to prevent people from hating us in the first place. And maybe folks are not thinking as much about the role that terrorism plays and what state plays in trying to counter that. Ambassador?
Well, thank you. It's important to note that one of probably the first office in the United States government focused solely on terrorism was in the State Department, created back in about 1980, the Office of the Coordinator for Combating Terrorism, which just has been turned into a full bureau in the Department of State. And this stems from the fact that we're talking about terrorism. We're talking about a phenomenon which is not about what governments do, although some of them get involved, which is global and which crosses borders. Now, the State Department is responsible in some degree, or certainly a central responsibility, for dealing with the outside world, what's going on out there.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a phenomenon here which is rampaging across the world and which state has to deal with. Because if we're going to deal with this problem, we have to deal with it in cooperation with other governments. I mean, terrorism is directed against us, but it's directed against lots of other people as well.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the main, if you will, themes of our fight against terrorism is to form a world community of responsible governments, all of whom are responsible and concerned about dealing with terrorism in their own country and in terrorism in the neighboring country because it flows across the borders. So state has a lead coordinating responsibility in the U.S. government, working with the Department of Defense and all these other agencies to focus our activities in a global communal sense outside the borders of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Kraft, the conversation about the State Department, as I mentioned, in most people's mind, I think the perception is that building that consensus among countries is only done before an incident, and once the incident happens, or an incident happens, state kind of is removed. Ambassador Marks's comments obviously draw a distinction there and kind of make that that point not true. What's the effect of the State Department's efforts to try to build that community of nations, responsible governments, and doing that in a context of sharing information that maybe some of these members of this group of nations might not want to be shared amongst other components of our government, state and local governments, and other countries?
I think it takes at two levels. One is sort of a general level of improving working relationships, cooperation, so other countries are more inclined to share information or latest techniques. For example, they discover in country X that terrorists are using technique Y, and that gets shared across. And there's a general network of relationships. There's also programs which State Department supervises, like training programs to improve the capability of law enforcement officials in other countries, the Anti-Terrorism Training Assistance Program. They've set up programs to help other countries guard their borders better, terrorist interdiction program. There's a number of these specific programs that, while they help improve the capabilities of these other countries, they also improve the working relationships. You know, it's sort of, you know, the captain to captain or major to major.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of this is built on personal relationships there. But there's another component, too, that just by developing good relations with a country, sometimes it pays off in a terrorism area. There's a story, I can't go into a lot of details, but in an Asian country, a political officer just doing his duty became friendly with a person in the opposition. The opposition person later became Home Secretary. A terrorist was found on their territory. He called up the American embassy and said, hey, if you send a plane over, you can have the suspect.
Mm-hmm.
We'll give him to another country, which had claim. And so it's just the result of having a good, strong embassy and good people overseas.
Mm-hmm.
Even though terrorism or counterterrorism is only a very small part of their job.
One final thought on this. There are people around the world in both governments and opposition groups that always suspect that the State Department is more than it seems to be when it comes to collecting information. Is that a significant component of dealing with people in other countries, that there is the suspicion that the State Department is not just there to facilitate relationships between their countries and the United States, that there is some kind of ulterior motive?
Well, there's nothing ulterior at all. The State Department and its embassies are some of the prime collectors of intelligence around the world. And this is a traditional role of diplomats. There's nothing surprising about it. People tend to think the intelligence is only what's gathered by James Bond type people who break into offices in the dead of night. Most of intelligence is about talking to other people. Mm. When an American diplomat talks to a member of a parliament, of the French parliament, they're exchanging information. So that is what we do, and intelligence and in terrorism has become one of the problems in which we're talking about other people and gathering intelligence on.
Now, what happens to that information, and who gets to hear that information and know that information? We addressed that issue briefly earlier in the program. When we come back to wrap up, I'd like to dig into that a little bit more to conclude our conversation today on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My guests are Michael Kraft and Ambassador Edward Marks. They're authors of U.S. Government Counterterrorism, A Guide to Who Does What. You can learn more about that book at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, and we'll be back to wrap up in just a moment.
And now the Federal Living Report, brought to you by WEPA.
Miss that mass transit subsidy that expired at the end of last year? The government's biggest union wants it back, too. The National Treasury Employees Union is lobbying lawmakers to reinstate it, calling it critical to workers struggling in a down economy. Supportive lawmakers are calling for the benefit to be included in a payroll tax extension that's being negotiated now. But Utah Senator Orrin Hatch gave a reality check. He told Reuters that passage was unlikely before the November election.
These are hard times for federal employees. A multi-year pay freeze, rumors of furloughs, and discussions on reducing benefits are the realities that all federal employees face. Now, more than ever, it's important to find ways to save your hard-earned money. One way is with life insurance from WEPA. WEPA offers lower rates and a premium refund policy that's returned over $58 million to its policyholders since 1996. To learn how much you can save, visit WAEPA.org. Once again, that's WAEPA.org.
To win and deliver government contracts successfully, you need to align with the right teaming partners. Meet Tech Systems. While often behind the scenes, Tech Systems has worked with government agencies and systems integrators for over 25 years. In fact, every year, they deploy over 70,000 IT professionals at over 5,500 client sites nationwide, including more than 65 government agencies. Tech Systems is active across a broad spectrum of government programs and has developed deep relationships who understand what works well and who does it best. Thinking about cybersecurity? Working on a cloud computing initiative? Tech Systems addresses critical program gaps related to people, projects, and work functions. Their delivery models scale from staff augmentation to IT project and outsourcing services to support transition, ramp-up, surge, and ongoing program support needs. Learn more at TechSystems.com, TEKSystems.com.
Soon this little baby I'm singing to sleep will start to walk. Before I know it, I'll be dropping her off at school, beaming when she walks up to accept her diploma, or holding back tears as she takes those big steps down the aisle. But before she takes all those steps, she and thousands like her will need you to take yours. Join March for Babies to help make her steps possible. March for Babies! Start your team today at marchforbabies.org.
Human Capital Management for Defense is a highly anticipated training conference with over 300 delegates and key speakers, such as Lieutenant General Daryl D. Jones, Deputy Chief of Staff for Manpower, Personnel and Services, U.S. Air Force, Honorable Thomas R. Lamont, Assistant Secretary of the Army, Manpower and Reserve Affairs, and Honorable Juan M. Garcia, Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Manpower and Reserve Affairs. This year's event will be held on March 12th through the 15th at the Sheraton National Hotel in Arlington. For more info, visit hcmdusa.com. Mention code FNR for a 25% discount.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My guests today are co-authors of the book U.S. Government Counterterrorism, A Guide to Who Does What, and you can learn more about it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Edward Marks and Michael Kraft are both in studio with me, been here for the hour, and this conversation, by the way, will be archived later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, so you can hear the conversation again anytime you like as well. One of the things that we've talked about in every segment a little bit, and I'd like to close out with today, is this idea of who gets to know what. We talked a little bit, Ambassador, you mentioned the concept of need to share versus need to know, and that's become the mantra by which the government is supposed to be working, and people can argue about the degrees of success that they're achieving. But one of the things that I am wondering how agencies are dealing with is just the flood of information and navigating that. What are you seeing and hearing from the people that you talk to about that element of information?
What's a major problem for those dealing with intelligence broadly defined, with information broadly defined? You need to, if you're working in that area, your job is to gather the information, massage it, put it together, and get it to the people who need to know it in order to operate.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, you have to do that in terms of your own organization and its mission. But also, are you getting stuff which would be necessary to people and working in other departments?
Mm-hmm.
The military intelligence people, of course, are looking for stuff that has implications for the military. But they're also getting stuff that they know state needs, treasury needs, commerce needs, and how to move it across without flooding everybody is the problem to which there is no answer. It's a constant challenge and management problem for everybody working in the area.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Kraft, the whole idea of information sharing we talk about that a lot, I think, from the push perspective, which is I have this and I either should share it with you or shouldn't share it with you. We haven't talked much, and maybe we can talk about this the next time you gentlemen come to the studio. We haven't talked about it much from the pull perspective, which is I suspect that you might have information about X, Y, and Z, and I need to know enough about what you have to be able to request that from you.
Well, let me give you an example. State Department, the intelligence section, INR, as they call it, intelligence research, that's the condo. If, say, somebody in State Department feels they want to get more information about a certain subject, whether terrorism or elsewhere, and so INR would be the conduit to the CIA and the rest of the intelligence community, say, hey, we need to know more about so-and-so or whatever's going on there. So that's one aspect of it, is reaching out, or if they want to do a paper and bring more material together. In the health area, which is pretty specialized, but, you know, the Center for Disease Control may want to know more information of what's going on in Bangladesh, and mm-hmm. they have a whole reporting network, which is not focused on terrorism, but the same labs would be used. And that may not necessarily be shared, but they would push or seek out to get the information.
I've made some notes about some of the things that we didn't get to or that we just touched on today. I'm going to tuck it in my copy of the book so that it doesn't get away from me, and I would love for you to come back and continue this conversation because we're just about out of time right now. Thank you very much, both of you, for being here today.
Well, thank you for having us.
Happy to do it. Ambassador Edward Marks and Michael Kraft, authors of the book U.S. Government Counterterrorism, A Guide to Who Does What. You've been listening to Federal News Radio 1500 AM, and hour number two of In Depth with Francis Rose is right around the corner.